Texas reports more than 12,500 total coronavirus deaths as hospitalizations continue to fall. 4,172 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 30th, 1,014 less than a week ago. They occupy 7.6% of hospital beds. 3,759 new cases were reported on August 30th. The latest positivity rate is 12.2%. 12,510 Texans have died as of August 30th. 90 more deaths reported than the day before and 1,140 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $43.16, up 19 cents. Now, coronavirus briefs. More than 25 million people have been infected with COVID-19 since the pandemic began, and at least 846,000 have died, according to Johns Hopkins University. A forecast from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention projects more than 200,000 coronavirus deaths in the United States by September 19th. Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Stephen Hahn told the Financial Times that the agency would be open to granting emergency approval for a vaccine before final large-scale trials are complete. Infighting among some of the nation's top scientists about the use of convalescent plasma preceded a stunning debacle for the FDA. One of President Trump's top medical advisors, Scott Atlas, a neurologist from Stanford's conservative Hoover Institution, is urging the White House to embrace a controversial herd immunity strategy to combat the pandemic. Now here's a short story. One shot of coronavirus vaccine likely won't be enough. When a coronavirus vaccine comes on the market, people will likely need two doses, not just one, and that could cause real problems. Some of the potential problems are logistical. Difficulties procuring test kits and protective gear throughout the pandemic point to supply chain issues that could also plague the distribution of double doses of vaccines for an entire country. Other potential concerns are more human. Convincing people to show up to get a vaccine not once but twice could be a formidable undertaking. There's no question that this is going to be the most complicated, largest vaccination program in human history, and that's going to take a level of effort, a level of sophistication that we've never tried before, said Dr. Kelly Moore, a health policy professor at Vanderbilt University. Now here's a longer article from CNN. With Canada and Mexico borders closed, Americans are trapped in their own healthcare system. Want to hear the joke about insulin? Goes the bleak gag about America's drug prices. You have to go to Canada to get it. But even that's not an option anymore. Pandemic travel restrictions have made Americans prisoners of their own country. Even within North America, Mexico and Canada have closed thousands of miles of border to all but essential travel, roiling plans for vacation, work, and school. For cash-strapped Americans, it has also cut off access to medicines and healthcare services that they can't afford at home, at a time when money is tighter than ever. Stephanie Boland's 9-year-old son was diagnosed with diabetes in December. Traveling to Canada to fill his insulin prescription took a half-day's drive from where they live in Brainerd, Minnesota, but it was worth it. The purchase was a simple over-the-counter affair. One pack of injection pens, which would last several months, cost less than $100, she says, compared to a list price of $530 at home. As their son's disease began to rewrite the routines of daily life, the Bolands planned to cross into Canada again to restock. Then the pandemic hit. Boland, a masseuse, was forced to stop working. Her husband, a self-employed financial advisor, found his income hit by pandemic-related turbulence in the markets, too. Then their source for affordable insulin vanished behind a border that had never been closed before in the history of U.S.-Canada relations. We were going to make a trip north, one more trip in March, but then they closed the border, she said. buying insulin abroad. Only 1.5% of American adults who take prescription medications buy their drugs abroad, according to a June analysis by researchers at the University of Florida Gainesville, based on a 2015 to 2017 National Health Interview survey. But that's still an estimated 2.3 million people. Many medicines and medical services are cheaper in neighboring Canada and Mexico, thanks to price controls and the power of the U.S. dollar. The difference is great enough that U.S. insurer PEHP, which covers Utah's state employees, offers partially paid trips to Vancouver and Tijuana to help you save your money on your prescriptions. In popular Mexican resort towns like Cabo San Lucas on the west coast or Tulum on the east coast, pharmacies, doctors, and dentists targeting U.S. clientele dot the main drag, their prices on bright display. And the difference between those prices and the costs of the same drugs at U.S. pharmacies can mean life or death. No drug is a better known example of that calculus than insulin, a vital hormone in the body's metabolism. 7 million American diabetics don't produce it naturally, or not enough of it, and need to inject it throughout the day. Without it, dangerous levels of glucose build up in the blood, damaging organs and producing a painful stupor. In a worst-case scenario, lack of insulin can kill within 3 days. Americans have been going to Canada for insulin since scientists learned how to produce it in labs at the University of Toronto in 1921. One of the first patients to try it was an American, Elizabeth Hughes, the teenage daughter of then U.S. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes. "I'm so happy and elated," she wrote in a letter to her mother from Canada, describing her first self-injection and the enormous meal she enjoyed afterward. Before crossing the border, the 15-year-old had managed her condition by starving herself, the only life-prolonging trick available to diabetics before insulin. 5 feet tall, she weighed only 45 pounds. 100 years later, and after national soul-searching over the soaring cost of insulin, some Americans are still starving themselves. Daniel Carlisle, a type 1 diabetic in Texas, has sometimes tried not to eat for days at a time in an effort to ration insulin. When he was 18 and short on cash, he even contemplated robbing a pharmacy, he says. "I always do the math about how many days' supply of insulin I have in the refrigerator," the 60-year-old Texan says. "That's how I know my lifespan at this point. My lifespan is measured in exactly how many days' worth of insulin I have on hand, plus 3 days." Nuevo Progreso. For the past 3 years, buying insulin in Mexico has brought Carlisle security. His trip started with a split tooth in 2017. "I went to a dentist near where I live, and he said he could repair it for like $10,000, says Carlisle, who is uninsured. "So I told him, look, I can't afford to send my kids to Harvard. Sure can't afford to send yours." He tried to ignore his aching tooth, but at the urging of his family, eventually drove a few hundred miles south from his home in Houston to the busy Mexican town of Nuevo Progreso. As soon as you come across the bridges, hawkers are saying, "Need a dentist? Need a pharmacy?" It's just constant, he says. First, he got his tooth fixed. A root canal, bridge, and crown all together would end up costing him just $750. The dentists aren't marble palaces, but they're clean, he says. Then he dipped into a pharmacy to ask the price of a vial of Humalog insulin, one of two kinds he takes. The answer? U.S. $70. He checked the expiration date on the box, then offered $20. "You've got to negotiate," he says. "I just tell them I'll die without it, and then they'll lose a customer. They don't put up a fuss." A vial of the same insulin in the U.S. has a list price of $274.70. Since then, that's the only place where he buys insulin, Carlisle says, and he's never had a problem with its quality. but with the borders closed, he doesn't expect to be back anytime soon. A vast gray area. Pharmacy staff in several drugstores in border towns in both Canada and Mexico tell CNN they've seen significant drops in foot traffic since their country's borders with the U.S. closed. Though American scoff laws have been accused of crossing into Mexico for non-essential errands, overall border crossings have plummeted. One young man working at a pharmacy near Tijuana told CNN that business had fallen about 40% since the border closed. He asked to remain anonymous because he was not authorized to speak about the business. Technically, bringing prescription drugs into the U.S. is illegal, but the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has created a gray area for small amounts. Importation might be allowed, according to the agency's website, if the medicine doesn't exceed a 3-month supply. Staff at Mark Marine Pharmacy in Vancouver, Canada, less than an hour's drive from the U.S. border, typically fills hundreds of orders for U.S. customers each day, General Manager Jordan Rosenblatt says, and rarely have any problems shipping it. With the borders closed, online ordering has spiked, he adds. Reviews over the years on their Facebook page compares prices of all kinds of prescription drugs to those in the U.S., with commenters from as far as New Jersey and Texas. They sell and send me my asthma inhalers at a price that is non-predatory, unlike here in the U.S. Happiest gal today, thank you, reads one comment. But ordering online isn't for everyone. There is always a risk that the medicine will be confiscated, or that temperature-sensitive drugs like insulin could go bad waiting at customs or in U.S. Postal Service delays. And as the frustrations of border closures highlight, foreign health systems make a poor fallback, no matter how you access them. For any given individual in the short run, going to Canada is a decent solution, but it's not a systemic solution, says Dr. Vikas Saini, a Harvard-trained cardiologist and president of the Lown Institute, a nonpartisan healthcare think tank. U.S. President Donald Trump has called to allow larger-scale importation from Canada, among a raft of recent proposals to reduce the prices of certain U.S. drugs. But that's unlikely to make a dent in the U.S. market, Saini says. Canada is a country of about 30 million people. It doesn't have enough medication to provide all those prescriptions for the U.S., a nation 10 times the size. Some Canadian health industry groups and patients agree. Since 2019, they've warned that Trump's importation plan could lead to drug shortages for Canadians, a fear likely sharpened after witnessing global shortages of vital medical equipment in the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic. A crumbling economy. As the pandemic wears on, the options are dwindling for Americans who can't afford to be sick in the United States, especially after the cratering economy erased nearly 13 million jobs, taking health insurance options with them. Even at Canadian prices, some are struggling to pay for their prescriptions. Recently, we're hearing about all the financial issues of people laid off, says Rosenblatt, the Vancouver pharmacy manager. We have American customers that have been working with us for years, and under these circumstances, we've sent what they needed and we tell them, pay us when you can. To make insulin more accessible, some U.S. states have pushed for price caps on copays. The three companies which control the U.S. insulin market offer discount plans, including new programs to which Americans who were financially impacted by the pandemic can apply for temporary access to cheaper or free insulin. And Walmart offers cheap insulin over the counter, though this is an older formulation that can make blood sugar management more complicated than newer prescription versions. Yet many are struggling, and not just the nearly 28 million Americans who don't have health insurance, a number estimated by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Even Americans with health insurance who benefit from negotiated prices that are lower than the list prices sometimes still can't afford all the costs of living with diabetes. In Dayton, Ohio, Mindy Patterson's family gets health insurance through her job as a Costco clerk. But even then, keeping up with the cost of insulin for both her teenage sons and her husband is still a tightrope walk. We have had to dig through the trash for discarded reservoirs from insulin pumps when we haven't had the money to buy the next bit of supplies, she says. Right now, I have a refill for my son's insulin waiting, but I really don't have the funds just yet to pick it up. So they're holding on to it for me until payday, she said. Sabrina Renaud, a 22-year-old dietary aide in South Carolina, works full-time at a hospital that offers health insurance to employees, but she earns about $1,300 per month after taxes and says she simply can't afford the deductible, premiums, and co-pays of the company plan and still make rent. So I thought, I'm just going to have to wiggle through this without health insurance, she says. Renaud hasn't seen a doctor to renew her insulin prescription in more than a year. Instead, every couple of months, she messages a woman she has never met in real life with a list of what she needs. So far, the life-saving supplies she needs keep turning up in the mail. The woman, who asked to remain anonymous because redistributing prescription drugs is illegal, tells CNN that she has shipped insulin to hundreds of people over the years, an effort she describes as a necessary evil. People from the U.S. and abroad send spare vials and injection pens to her, and she then sends them for free to any American who asks for it. I personally do this, gosh, an average of 4 times per week, she says. I could put out a tweet right now that someone needs insulin brand, Humalog, and I'll probably get 100 responses saying, I have extra from all over the country, she says. Folks are willing to pay $50 to overnight it to someone who's in a really bad situation. She has even received large insulin donations from Canada. An increasingly busy black market. More than a dozen diabetic Americans interviewed for this article said they had participated in such an informal insulin exchange powered by social media, widely referred to as the black market. Organizers are nodes in the network, using their prominence on platforms like Twitter to connect people who have insulin to those who don't. The FDA does not recommend sharing or reselling diabetic supplies, including insulin, due to concerns about the safety and efficacy of such resold or shared products, an agency spokesman told CNN. But defenders of the network says they can't stop, pointing to several deaths of diabetic Americans who rationed their insulin. We have been left with no other choice, says emerging Minnesota politician Quinn Nystrom, whose campaign for Congress emphasizes affordable health care. A type 1 diabetic herself, Nystrom helps distribute insulin donations, before the pandemic, organized caravans to Canada to purchase insulin. Am I willing to break the law to keep American citizens alive? Yes, she says. Demand for black market insulin has spiked since the pandemic began, said another organizer in Colorado who asked to remain anonymous due to the illegality of the work. In the last week of July alone, she facilitated $24,000 worth of insulin donations, she estimates. Prior to this whole COVID-19 crisis, let's say just 6 months ago or 8 months ago, I might hear from someone who needed insulin maybe once a month, she says. Fast forward to now, when people are losing jobs, in the last 7 days, I've heard from 15 different people who are almost out of insulin and have no way to afford their next purchase. Daniel Carlisle, the Houstonian, has sometimes donated some of his own supply to fellow diabetics in Houston and Dallas. If someone died because they were lacking and I said I won't share with you, well, I've got a real moral issue with that, he says. If you were living in Houston and needed some insulin, I would drive over and give you a vial. But he does have cash flow limits, he adds. And if he can't restock in Nuevo Progreso soon, he'll have to ask for help on the same black market he once gave to. Right now, I'm looking at February. If I can't make it to Mexico by then and have the money to make the trip, I'll be in trouble, he says. Reporting contributed by CNN's Natalie Gallon in Mexico City. Now we're going to move to education. From the Texas Tribune, we're all holding our breath. Health experts on school reopenings in Texas. As schools and universities across Texas begin reopening, families, students, and educators are adjusting to remote instruction, schools are preparing to file weekly reports on COVID-19 cases, and universities are providing free on-campus coronavirus testing. The Texas Tribune spoke to epidemiologists and health experts about what the state can expect with schools and universities resuming online or in-person instruction. The Tribune also talked to the same experts about the state's coronavirus data backlog. Question: as hospitalizations decline, schools and universities are reopening and already seeing outbreaks, and Labor Day is coming up. What do you think the state can expect in the weeks ahead? Dr. Ron Cook, professor at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and the City of Lubbock's Public Health Authority. I think we're all holding our breath on what opening schools and opening colleges and universities is going to do. So I think we're going to see a surge. I think we'll see a surge of positive cases in the next 10 days to 2 weeks. That student population more than likely will do pretty well. But another 10 days after that, we may see those that come in contact may not do so well. Catherine Triosi, infectious disease epidemiologist at UT Health School of Public Health in Houston. It is great news, of course. The hospitalizations have been declining, probably due to better treatment. We've learned a lot about the infection and the fact that it's younger people being infected and they are less likely to have more severe outcomes and need to be hospitalized. It may also be that people are getting tested earlier, so the disease is caught earlier and supportive measures can be given. However, there is a concern that the fact that hospitalizations are going down will be taken as a sign that, oh, we can go back to normal, because we're all tired of this. We were tired of it 4 months ago, and now we're really tired of it. We've got a holiday weekend coming up, Labor Day weekend, and we saw what happened 4th of July and Memorial Day. The fact that schools are opening is a big experiment, particularly the elementary schools and the role of children in the spread of this virus. And there's a lot we don't know. Colleges, it's less of an experiment because I think we know what's going to happen. 18-year-olds, first of all, think they're invincible. They're not going to die of anything. They're social animals. They haven't seen their friends since March. It is understandable that they are not going to keep up masking and particularly physical distancing. And any time you get a lot of people together, especially when 40 to 50% of them are infected and don't know that they are, there's a possibility of spread. The short answer to your question is, yes, we're concerned. We've got these three things happening, and I would predict that we're going to see an increase in cases. Dr. James McDivitt, Dean of Clinical Affairs at Baylor College of Medicine. I've got a forecast and I've got a fear. My forecast is hopeful, but my fear is that history could repeat itself. We had what we thought was a surge in April that turned out not to be really a surge, but sort of an appetizer. And then we hit all the events of the summer. Many factors were in play. The early May and mid-May reopening of the economy, the 4th of July holiday, the George Floyd protests, a general lack of patience with social distancing on the part of the public, and the politicization of masking. I don't think it was any one of those things that caused the second surge that we saw. They likely all contributed to a degree. But clearly in July, we saw a surge that was at least five times what we experienced in April. We skated right up to the point that we were risking overrunning our hospital system capacity, though thankfully we never did. Well, now we've come to this backside of that surge, and my fear is that we'll lose our focus. We still have a relatively immunologically naive population out there that is susceptible to the virus. With the upcoming holidays, school reopenings, a looming flu season, there are a lot of dynamics at play that could reignite the spread of the virus. I don't think we can adopt an attitude that the cavalry is going to ride in to rescue us. I don't think a vaccine will emerge and suddenly the virus vanishes. My guess is by December, we will probably see one of the vaccines in current Phase 3 clinical trials demonstrate adequate safety and effectiveness and will start to be distributed. But to get to the point that adequate numbers of people, or high-risk subpopulations of people, are actually vaccinated to the point we develop a degree of herd immunity, I think we're looking at springtime. And that's if everything goes like clockwork, which it won't. So the reality is, if we are going to be able to resume some semblance of life as we knew it before COVID-19, we need to adopt good masking, distancing, and hygiene practices for a good long while, for months to come. We will have a vaccine. We'll get there and this will end, but it's not going to be tomorrow. So I think that it's important for people to get their heads around that. We're in this, all of us together, for the long haul. Now our next article is from Time Magazine. This is what it's like to be a teacher during the coronavirus pandemic, by Katie Riley, published August 26, 2020. In 2018, as teacher protests were sweeping the country, Time spoke with several teachers who described how wage stagnation and budget cuts were affecting their lives, forcing them to take on second jobs and spend hundreds of dollars of their own money on school supplies, or preventing them from being able to afford children of their own. 2 years later, as educators face an entirely new set of challenges caused by the coronavirus pandemic, we followed up with these teachers to see how they're preparing for an unprecedented school year. Read their stories below. Comments have been condensed and edited for clarity. Kara Stoltenberg, 30, language arts teacher at Norman High School in Norman, Oklahoma, which started the school year virtually on August 24th. As a teacher, I don't feel like a lot has changed in the last few years. Oklahoma teachers did get a pay increase, which was awesome. My salary is now about $41,000. It had really felt paycheck to paycheck, and now I am able to save, and budgeting feels much less stressful. But the state of Oklahoma still has work to do. We still need a lot more funding for education. Class sizes are still large. I still buy a lot of my own supplies. I am relieved that we started the school year virtually. It's been a whirlwind, and everyone is being asked to do more than they can do in a day, so I'm just trying to be patient and offer solutions when I can come up with them. The first day of school, it's so cheesy, but it can be really magical, and it's just so fun seeing the kids excited to be around their friends and to be back together as a community. It does feel like we're really missing that this year. I am teaching in an empty classroom, and it's kind of sad, but it was so nice to actually interact with students, even virtually, because the school has felt so empty. My colleagues and I have been stressed since spring break because we care, and we're worried, and we know the ins and outs of our jobs, and we know that what the CDC is recommending for in-person learning just isn't really feasible, considering the lack of funding that we've had for a decade. I'm not an online teacher. I've not been trained to do any of this, and I don't want my students to be at a loss because I'm in uncharted territory. I just hope people know that we are trying our absolute best, and it's hard to make a decision that pleases everyone. It just feels like an impossible situation. Jessica Matthews, 43, English teacher at Carmen Ainsworth High School in Flint, Michigan, which is planning to begin the school year remotely through the month of September. Michigan was one of the states that was heavily affected by COVID-19 first. My students have lost family members, and there's a lot of trauma we are not addressing. When COVID hit, I had kids who were texting me in the middle of the night, and I answered them every single time. As the school year starts, care needs to come before content. We cannot just hop in and learn algebra. This whole situation is a reflection of all the things that were wrong with education before COVID hit. Everyone knows equity is a huge problem. Everyone in education knew that the lack of technology was a problem. The large number of students who did not have the tools to do any kind of learning at home was already tremendous. You're already leaving some behind. Some schools have everything they need to do everything, and they're majority white, and they're middle-class schools. Everyone else is sitting back going, "We've never had what we needed, but now we're supposed to just make it work in the middle of a pandemic?" The pandemic exposed all of those things. Starting the school year virtually is the safest option, but no means is it the easiest. It will be incredibly hard for teachers to do their job. I've been thinking about what I can do to have a space of respect, love, and liberty for all of us. That's really hard in a virtual space, but safety and care are supposed to be at the forefront all the time in education. So if virtually doing education is the way for us to protect everyone during this time, that is what we should be doing. I want to be safe. People say teachers aren't working. We're working harder than ever. Shantae Branton, 36, first grade teacher at Eddie Bernice Johnson Elementary School in Wilmer, Texas, which will begin the school year with distance learning until at least October 6th. Teaching first graders virtually this spring was tough. It's easier for bigger kids because they know how to navigate through the various programs, and most high school kids already do a lot of learning with technology. For our students, it was a challenge because they could not do the programs by themselves. They had to have help. I had a few parents who were working, and they just couldn't stop and help their child. A lot of parents were overwhelmed, so I went through each assignment and videotaped myself doing it, showing them how to circle a noun in a sentence or count money. I had some grandparents who were raising their grandchildren, and the technology was just over their head, so I drove to their homes and gave them actual packets to work on. I feel most children learn better when they're in the classroom, where we can do more exploring. I know the benefits of them socially interacting with their peers and learning from their peers. I just want leaders to do what's best for the children. At the end of the day, I'm one person, and there are millions of children out there who need to be educated. Some people feel like teachers just don't want to go to work, and that's not true. A lot of teachers have underlying health conditions and concerns, and we're fearful for our babies. We see different people hosting meetings virtually, and then they're telling us, just send the kids to school. We want them to be safe. We're going to have to work regardless, whether it's virtually or at school. Teaching virtually was a lot of work than actually teaching in class, but we want what's best for the kids. Jacob Fertig, 33, art teacher at Riverside High School in Bell, West Virginia, which is planning to begin in-person learning for some students in September. Part of my concern with school reopening is that nationwide, about a quarter of our teachers are in the age range where this is really dangerous. They're playing Russian roulette with the most experienced educators. I just had a conversation with a group of teachers, and it's so bad that I know a couple of them are leaving. They're done. School principals shouldn't be the ones having to make life or death decisions for our communities. It's not on our backs how the economy does. But every time there's a crisis in our communities, in some ways, there's the perception that we're supposed to be the ones handling it. Are we going to get the materials we need? Are there going to be enough masks? That's going to cost more money that we don't have. A significant percentage of our school-aged students are living with a grandparent, and even if you argue the virus doesn't affect kids as severely, it does affect old people. If their grandparents die, they don't have anybody else. I've got students who are working full-time. These kids are trying to keep their households afloat. Those problems are so much bigger than what their grades are. To me, it's ridiculous that going back to school is the hill to die on for some people. Why don't you say, right now is not a good time. We'll put it online. There are children that are having to live adult lives right now. Stop trying to force this thing. We'll get there. But right now, you're creating a whole lot of stress. Grant Ruby, 42, math teacher at Lincoln High School in Tacoma, Washington, which will begin the school year remotely. A lot of high school kids don't like math, and one of the ways that I convince them just to show up to class is by being the goofy teacher who cares about them. It's going to be a lot harder to be that person on a computer screen when I don't have the opportunity to have those one-on-one conversations or even stand at my classroom door and welcome every student into the classroom. It's going to be really interesting to see how engagement online this year compares to engagement in my regular classroom when it's not a pandemic, and I expect it to decrease significantly. During the spring, I only had about 10% of my students engaging each week in remote learning. I don't expect as many students to pass classes this year as do normally, just because it's going to be a lot easier to check out. If a kid is on a computer screen, how do I know that they're engaged with what I'm talking about? How do I know they're not on their phone? It's better than being in person and crossing our fingers, hoping no one dies. Certainly it's not ideal. I would rather be in person with my kids, but I can't be right now. I got into teaching because I wanted to spend time with kids all day. I want to mentor them. I'm in a position to share my knowledge and experience and goofiness with young people and hopefully improve their lives and have fun. I don't know if I'm really going to be doing that this year. Nashonda Cook, 45, special education teacher at Millbrook Magnet High School in Raleigh, North Carolina, which began the school year virtually on August 17th. Meeting students for the first time virtually, I wasn't sure what to expect, but it hasn't been as difficult because they're in the comfort of their home, and we've done different icebreakers that actually work at home. Find an object in your house and show it to us and tell us what it means to you. I'm still building relationships with them, and this is an opportunity to do it on a different level. But I'm absolutely hoping to go back in person eventually, because my students need it, and so do I. I'm an eighth education educator. It's something that is a part of me, being able to give them a hug and have a conversation and look them in the eyes. I'm able to do a lot of things online, but I can't give them that boost of confidence. I can't make eye contact when they need that, when that light bulb moment is flickering, and they need to see that safe space, even if just looking at me reminds them to have the courage to ask a question or give an answer. I can't do that online. I think teachers are doing what we've always done. We've taken what we've been handed, and we are making sure that our students get the best educational experience possible. And we are continuing to stay up late at night, trying to figure out how to make that happen. We don't want our kids to get the short end of this pandemic and lose out on things that they have a right to, things that they so desperately need. Nathan Bowling, 40, social studies and AP government and politics teacher at the American Community School of Abu Dhabi, an international private school that is welcoming students back for in-person instruction with alternating schedules. I left Lincoln High School in Tacoma, Washington last year to teach abroad. I've been told repeatedly that schools abroad want American teachers, in particular, because if you can teach and thrive in an American public school, you can teach and thrive anywhere. What's different now is my day is more realistic. I have more planning time. I have smaller class sizes. And my students are set up for success by having their basic life needs met in a way I haven't experienced at other points in my career. The job description of a teacher in a prototypical American public school, in particular a high poverty school, is very long. Teacher, counselor, social worker. Society does not care or does not acknowledge that for millions of low-income students, basic life needs are not being met, and the burden to fill those gaps often falls to teachers. At my current school, my students' needs are being met, so my job is just to teach. There are about 10 million people in the United Arab Emirates, a population slightly greater than Washington State or New York City. Throughout the pandemic, there have been about 370 COVID-19 deaths in the UAE, a fraction of the deaths in Washington State or New York City. Because of the way they handled the virus, demonstrating competent leadership, we're going back to school face-to-face with a modified schedule this fall. If I was teaching in the United States, I would have way more concerns given the way things are right now. Ben Tai, 43, humanities teacher at University Neighborhood Middle School in New York City, where school is slated to start with a mix of in-person and remote learning in September. The spring was really like emergency teaching. We had little time to prepare for remote learning. Attendance was an issue. I had students performing in the 90th percentile who just disappeared. I contacted parents just to check in on the social and emotional state of the students, as well as their family. I stressed over how to maintain their learning and get them to grow academically when they weren't coming to class consistently. A lot of the systems and the classroom routines that we had established from the beginning of the year fell apart. I received a medical accommodation to teach remotely this fall. My biggest concern is that I'm teaching incoming sixth graders. I've never met them before. They're brand new students. Building a relationship with them where they can trust me as a facilitator of their learning, I think that's the biggest worry I have right now. We won't get to play games, and we don't get to plant the garden that we normally do every year. Things that I feel are central to my classroom community and what gets students to trust me enough to ask for help. I'm afraid of students just sitting there in silence for 30 school days and not knowing how to make it better. There's nothing I can do to force them to participate. We're preparing to revamp our curriculum so that it's a lot more responsive to the students. Hope Brown, 54, U.S. history teacher at Woodford County High School in Versailles, Kentucky, which is beginning the school year virtually and planning to resume in-person instruction in September. The pandemic has changed everything about teaching. I'm worried about both the potential health risks of going back in person and also the loss of the learning environment we had. In classrooms, if possible, we'll all have to do 6 feet of social distancing and wear masks. It's almost like I have to go back to standing in front of the room and lecturing to kids who are all sitting in one direction, not working together, not analyzing together, not collaborating, not being creative. To me, it just feels so dry and institutionalized. There won't be assemblies or pep rallies. The marching band season has already been canceled. Everything that makes kids like coming to school is just gone. I think maybe kids and families have in their head that it's going to be like before COVID, but it's not going to be anything like that. I understand the desire to reopen. I understand it as a person who had small children at one time. A lot of it is because there's such a need for parents to get back to work, and they have to have some place for the kids to go. So I feel like that's how we are viewed. Just some place for kids to go while parents are working. I don't know what the solutions are to this. There is no good solution. I'm worried for my students. I'm worried for my own kids. The district is trying to do the best they can. It's just an awful situation to be in. And if we had had clear direction from the beginning of this, and it had not become politicized, then maybe we would be in a position where things were back to normal by the time school started. Now, in our remaining time today, we're going to bring you a few pre-recorded stories. Our first is from NPR, and it relates on the educational theme that we've been reading, this one from the parents' point of view. As virtual learning continues, some families struggle with sharing tech. Now, here's a story about another occupation that's having to change in the era of the pandemic. Occupational therapist discusses treating COVID-19 patients.
Working from home means something different for Alicia Johnson.
Next one. Chest out like you're squeezing your shoulder blades together.
She's an occupational therapist in the Atlanta area and works in other people's homes.
How you feel? Good, bad, happy, sad, indifferent?
I feel fine.
Okay.
Before the pandemic, Alicia Johnson tended to work with people who'd had amputations or who were recovering from strokes or a debilitating fall.
I love helping people. The kind of therapy that I would do with these patients is to improve their activities of daily living, to wake up, wash your face, brush your teeth, brush your hair, put your shirt on or your pants, to be able to get in and out of the bed safely.
Ready to repeat?
Yeah.
All right.
She's been an occupational therapist for 16 years. This spring, when her employer asked her to take on COVID patients, she had to seriously consider whether to stay with the career that she genuinely loves.
It did cross my mind to quit my job. It's like COVID, ooh, you know what I mean? So I did have fears and concerns. Am I going to be a carrier for the disease? Will I get my family sick? With a household of 7 people, I don't know how we would quarantine because we share every space of this living space. But the reality is I still have to work and be a provider along beside my husband. So I had to just buckle up and say, this is what we're doing. I am currently seeing COVID patients, about 5 or 6. Going into people's homes with COVID, the best way to keep myself safe is wear the full gear. So the mask, goggles, or face shield, a gown, gloves, and shoe covers. And we always perform hand hygiene after care. I would say initially there is a bit of fear there, but in the midst of working, that's not on my brain. At that moment, it's like, how can I help this patient? What is it? What impairments are present? And what is it that we need to focus on to help them regain their strength and their health back? You gonna stay?
Yeah. I can walk over there.
Okay, well, come on. Let's go. Yay! The needs of COVID patients, the biggest thing is the endurance and the fatigue associated with it.
You want to take the braces off?
Pop, come on, yourself.
And then the confinement, the quarantine process. When I enter a patient's home, they're happy to see somebody else coming in to see them. It's like, people, you know, coming in as if the patient is a friend or family member of mine and trying to keep a smile on your face at the same time. I think that goes a long way with the rehabilitation process. I recently just discharged my very first COVID patient. It's like when I discharge a patient, I feel like it's releasing a dove. I'm often sad because you create a relationship and you look forward to seeing your patients every week. It's like we build on each other. There are like a lot of taboos or a lot of stigmas associated with the virus, but my COVID patients have taught me to definitely treat everybody like you want to be treated, to appreciate life more, to do my best 100% of the time, and to be a better caregiver at home and at work.
Alicia Johnson, an occupational therapist from Lithonia, Georgia. She told us that when she gets home, she gets out of her protective gear and into some chips, salsa, and guac, and checks in with her family about their day. Her five children are learning online this year, a decision they made to help lower their family's risk for COVID. Alicia Johnson gets tested every 2 weeks and is doing everything that she can to stay healthy.
And in our final pre-recorded report today, here's something from the Texas Standard. Data discrepancies hinder Texas's contact tracing efforts.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The answer to the question, how many people have contracted the coronavirus in Texas? Well, it depends on who you ask. State health authorities will give you one number. Individual counties will give you another. The discrepancy makes it difficult, to say the least, when it comes to gauging exactly how the virus has affected the Lone Star State, especially when Texas's modest number of contact tracers can't keep up with all the cases that come across their desk. Here to tell us more about what's behind all this, Alexandra Villarreal. She is a Texas-based freelance reporter for The Guardian. Alexandra, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been reporting on data dumps in the past, you know, sort of backlogs of information about who's getting the coronavirus and where. You've been writing about the problems we're having with data reporting and contact tracing. How would you contrast how contact tracing is supposed to work versus how it's actually happening here in Texas?
Well, when Governor Greg Abbott talked about the state's contact tracing effort in late April, as he announced Texas could begin the process of reopening, he actually used very specific language. He said that the contact tracing effort in Texas would box in the expansion of COVID-19. Contact tracers make contact with new cases, and then they trace their recent interactions to see who may have been exposed. So ideally, they're making contact quickly enough to stem infections within the community and avoid any major outbreaks. But during a nightmarish summer here in Texas, that apparatus fell apart, at least on the local level in some of the hardest hit communities. One county judge described what contact tracers in her area were doing during an inundation of cases earlier this summer as a reverse alert, which is obviously less effective. Part of that is turnarounds for testing. As Harvard professor of global health Ashish Jha told me, test results that come back after more than 72 hours are essentially useless for contact tracing. Tests are turning around quicker now, but the Texas Department of State Health Services said they still take 2 to 3 days to get results. And then just on the statewide effort, they turn around and contact new cases within about 24 hours. So altogether, that's right at the threshold of relevance, if not after.
Well, if that's happening, is it, I mean, it sounds like a lot of this data, that it's useless after that 72-hour mark passes. And yet, as I understand it, there are, what, 4,000 contact tracers in Texas? And many of those contact tracers already feel overwhelmed. Is this all for naught?
So it's not all for naught. There are just under 4,000 contact tracers, about half of them at local health departments, according to Texas Department of State Health Services, in the state of Texas as of last week. And even at the height of the pandemic here in Texas, both Jha and the Department of State Health Services made the point to say that any infections that are caught matter to the individuals. And if you can bring down that percentage of infections by even 20%, that is significant. It's just not the sort of cure-all or the solve that Governor Abbott made it seem when he announced reopening.
What did experts tell you about what Texas needs to fix? Is it in the reporting of the data at the local level? Do we need more contact tracers? As a practical matter, what needs to be done to get these local figures and state figures in line in a way that can actually make a difference?
Sure. What I heard about the discrepancies in data is that they are inherent to the way that the data is being collected. And so, for example, with fatalities, the state is using death certificates, whereas counties are relying on local reports from their hospital systems, et cetera. And so those discrepancies exist because of the methodology. And so it would take changing the methodology to have them align. Now, what I was told by Ashish Jha, the Harvard professor, was that he would likely rely more on the county data. And across the board, you know, counties talked about they trusted their data more just because it was usually more updated and more exact to their situation. So I don't know how exactly to align that data just because it is a methodological difference. But in terms of which numbers to trust, most experts seem to be leaning on that county data that I spoke to.
Alexandra Villarreal has been reporting on this story for The Guardian. We'll have a link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Alexandra, thanks.
Thank you so much.
And that is your coronavirus update for this last day of August, August 31st, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up, we'll bring you national news with USA Today and then our local news. Here are some of the articles at 3 o'clock that we'll be reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Looking for solace. Attorney says lawsuit by victims' families is about accountability. Board president to address MISD's progress. Will Hurd reflects on lessons from time in office. Crude prices end week with gain. We are Permian Basin strong. West Texans will make it through this tragedy. And the Odessa American is continuing with some articles from its series, Odessa Strong, 1 year later. Gifts of love offer hope. Families of victims file lawsuit. Grievance aimed at expansion of background checks. Lessons learned from tragedy in Odessa. OPD, ECSO, take additional steps to stay ready for the unexpected. Father missed by entire family. Those are just a few of the articles from our local papers that our volunteers will be reading this afternoon at 3 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, more news. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Saturday and Sunday mornings, enjoy a variety of religious publications and features. Saturdays at 7 a.m., it's Guidepost Magazine, followed at 8 a.m. with the week's Sunday school lessons. Those are repeated Sundays beginning at 4 a.m. Then Sunday mornings at 6, it's Catholic Today. And at 7, Christianity Today. On Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 95 and partly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, it's Monday, August 31st, 2020, the last day of August. We're reading the USA Today this morning, and the headline article is Leaders of Change Meet Today's Leading Voices for Civil Rights. Which people in America are emerging as the next John Lewis's? That question quickly became the touchstone for USA Today Network's Leaders of Change project. It also quickly became clear that it would be difficult to find all that Lewis, who died last month after a lifetime of activism, meant to civil rights in one person. Ultimately, we identified more than 40 national and local activists, environmentalists, artists, filmmakers, politicians, athletes, and others who are in the vanguard of the modern civil rights movement, pushing for change and educating the public. You'll find some of their inspiring stories on these pages and even more at leadersofchangeusatoday.com. We hope you agree with our picks. More than that, we'd like to know who you would nominate as a leader of change in your community. So let's go to page 4, and it's entitled Leaders of Change. Let's see what they say are 10 leaders you should know. It has been 3 months since the death of